Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Rob Cornell joins us now. He's ING's chief international economist, joining us here in Bloomberg's European headquarters in London. And let's just take stock of where things stand right now. The swoon that we've seen about the prospects for new economic policy coming from President-elect Donald Trump. Are we seeing the markets treat that more soberly now? There was such wild enthusiasm after the elections. Are we seeing some reevaluation or taking stock of the fact that it may not happen as people would like it to happen or may not happen as quickly?
Well, we certainly don't think it'll happen quite as quickly or quite to the extent that I think people thought in the immediate aftermath of the election result. However, we will, over the next couple of weeks, get the president's budget, you know, which is, you know, a kind of Christmas present wish list, which will have everything in it. I mean, you know how these work. You ask for everything on the assumption that you'll only get some of it. So I think that could provide another boost. But I think in the very short term, we have seen a bit of a not so much a reevaluation, just a we've gone a bit too far. Let's just take stock a little bit and wait and see what happens now.
You mentioned that Christmas list, and I just think of the fact that we haven't really had a traditional budget process in Washington, D.C. for so long now, that regular order seems like a thing of the past. Do you expect that we'll see a return to it? We'll have Republicans controlling both houses of Congress and the White House as well. Do you expect to return to what was traditionally the process in Washington, regular order, getting a budget from the White House, getting a budget from Congress, not having all of these continuing resolutions and stopgaps?
Yeah, I think that seems to be the most likely way of it. I mean, I dare say that Donald Trump won't be totally delighted with everything that Congress suggests he can have in the end, but I think he's got room to be optimistic that at least on the tax-cutting front, they'll give him something, maybe not as much and not as quickly, and maybe it'll be more staged, but there's certainly room for improvement on taxes. And let's face it, what's not to like about lower taxes? Everybody loves that.
There is so much uncertainty right now here in the UK, here in the US, especially when it comes to trade policy. We were looking at the remarks from Theresa May, the Prime Minister, over the weekend, looking for some guidance on what trade policy in the UK might look like going forward. We're certainly doing that in the US as well. You've seen the tweets, as we all have here. Do we have a better sense of what Donald Trump's trade policy is going to be going forward? What do you look to for evidence of that?
Yeah, well, I think we've been looking at this really long and hard over the last couple of weeks to try and get a sense of this. This is the really crucial factor. The fiscal side's interesting and it's important, and it does make a difference to domestic growth. But trade's the really big one. That's the one he can really mess up on. And with the appointment of, you know, four very key trade members of his cabinet and his team, all of whom have been extremely outspoken and negative about China and Chinese trade, that the rumors that there is going to be a sort of blanket import tariff going in, that is beginning to make us think, well, maybe it is going to be a tougher trade Trump than we thought initially. And that could also have an impact on market sentiment.
I was talking with Michael Froman, the U.S. Trade Representative, yesterday, sort of an exit interview with him as he prepares to leave that office. He's had a tough go of it, trying to push for the Trans-Pacific Partnership to no avail, maybe shaking his fist at the heavens as the ship went down. And one thing we talked about was the way that his office looks to be reconfigured going forward. You mentioned the role of commerce in the new term. It seems like Wilbur Ross might take a larger role in negotiating trade deals. There is this trade council chaired by Peter Navarro. Is there a risk to that in not having it as centralized as it has been, the negotiation for trade deals, the person bringing about enforcement actions, the WTO?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think the era of big multilateral trade deals really is pretty much over. I think a lot of countries have realized that they can actually make much quicker progress and much more sort of substantial progress on individual smarter bilateral trade deals. I think there's going to be a lot more of that going on, and for that you don't need such a centralized mechanism.
You look at the balance that you have to strike between free trade and security, and that's certainly in acute focus here in the UK and in Europe. When you're making that balance, is security always going to win out? How do you toe that line?
Oh, and that's a really tough one. I mean, I think security is often an excuse that the policymakers will just fall back on for anything they don't particularly like or anything that they don't think is going to go down particularly well with the general public. I mean, it has to be a factor that you bear in mind, in particular when you're talking about energy. It's one of those crucial factors that has to be taken into account. But I'm not sure. I think it is a bit of a scapegoat at times for when they want to do what they want to do.
I know Tom wants to talk a bit about Fed policy. He was heralding your knowledge of the
Rob
Fed.
Rob is, I consider the major London axe on actual Fed policy, and you have a huge advantage of that, of being distant. There's something about, we've learned that over the years, it's something about an American economist in Minnesota or North Carolina, as Dennis Gartman is. You have a big advantage being in London. To our American listeners, what is the major distinction between the Washington Central Bank and the London Central Bank?
I would say that the Fed is a much more political animal. I think the Bank of England is also political, but of all the central banks, I think all the independent central banks, I'd say the Fed is possibly the least independent. I think it's much more attuned. It's not driven by, it's not forced by or cajoled by, but I think it's certainly influenced far more by politics than most of the other central banks around the G7.
Which goes to Mr. Trump and the House Financial Services Committee, et cetera. Which will you watch? Will you watch the executive branch or the Republicans on the Hill to see a change in tone towards our central bank?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the answer to that one is. I mean, I think there's very definitely a sense from Donald Trump that he would like to have more control over the Fed. I mean, there's been the talk about auditing the Fed. I mean, of course, the Fed is already audited as a financial institution,
yeah,
but its monetary policy decisions have not been audited. I'm interested to know how that's going to go. I mean, that clearly makes the Fed a less, yeah, an even less independent central bank.
I love this, David, being in London and talking about Richmond, Virginia. Mr.
Lacker yeah,
retires, and there's a character to Al Broaddus's Richmond Fed, it has a certain tone. Is there a Carnell shortlist who will darken the door in Richmond? Marvin Goodfriend's always on the list at Carnegie Mellon.
There isn't. I'm always fascinated whoever comes in. I mean, you go through this ritual process where the newbie has to be evaluated, and they typically toe the line and behave in very much a sort of neutral fashion, at least the first three meetings, as they get their toe under the table and work out exactly where they sit and how the process works. And then you start to see them
yeah,
sort of throw their weight around. And, of course, they are reflecting the regional reality of where they're coming from. And so, you know, very different economies going
yeah,
on all around the U.S.
They're all original folks, and you really wonder how our new president will, how everyone will adapt and adjust to the demands of a new executive branch. From London, David Gurin, Tom Keene, Bloomberg Surveillance, here in the United Kingdom, around the world, across America. David, you do a data check and you just migrate immediately to peso and lira. The emerging market stories are really something.
Yeah, that depreciation seemingly continuing there. You talk about Jeff Lacker. I think he's a guy who started out at the Richmond Fed, was an economist in the research department at the Richmond Fed. That'll be something that'll be difficult to replace as well, someone with that much institutional knowledge of the place. But you're right, looking at currencies this morning, sterling as well. I've been looking at that, seeing that weaken at 121.18 right now.
In Turkish lira with a new leg up, it's going to go through the recent weakness that we've seen this morning. Rob Carnell with us with the ING as we look at the central bank of the United States. We were talking in the break about Bullard, Lacker retiring at Richmond. Bullard of St. Louis has had a unique impact. St. Louis, known as a research house with decades, and of course their great statistical and chart base that they have. But the splash last year was a short paper, a little paper, even Bullard admitted that, about the x-axis, and that guys like you, Rob, always look at the y-axis, the up and down, or whatever the chart is, and the time function is usually ignored. Bullard says, don't ignore the time function, and where we're heading is regime change. We get somewhere, things change, the Fed changes. Do you believe that's feasible? Could we ever implement Bullard regime change?
I think it is feasible. I think it's a very accurate description of the world we live in. That the U.S. and much of the developed world, Europe, the U.K., has been in this low growth, low productivity environment for a very long period. Now, I think Bullard's point was along the lines of it's difficult to see how that's going to change anytime soon. But at some point, it actually will. And when it does, it'll happen in a fairly step-like fashion. That's the point at which the Fed, or whatever central bank is involved, will have to react very, very rapidly or find itself massively behind the curve. Whether or not central banks can do that in reality is another question. I have my doubts.
How do you process what Fed presidents say, what they think, what they're believing at this point? Are you reading every speech? Is there a particular president you don't hear enough from that you'd like to hear more from? Tom and I were talking a few weeks back about how there can be a cacophony here where you're just trying to figure out if there's some consensus among all of these participants in the Federal Reserve system. How do you process all of it?
I do sometimes wonder whether it's worth the effort, partly because I've always felt that the way that the Fed was structured, the insiders in effect rule the roost. What they want to happen.
Those are the governors.
The governors, yeah.
New York
President
Fed.
New York yeah. Fed, vice chair, etc. They basically set policy. And if the regional Fed president come alongside, all well and good, because it makes it look as if everybody's unanimous. But I'm not sure that on their own, those four rotating regional Fed members can ever really change policy unless it had already been agreed by the insiders. And, typically just the waiting means that's very unlikely to happen. Interesting for the debate, and often, I think, in Bullard's case, gives you a sense of where the debate's going, but doesn't necessarily give you any sense of exactly what's going to happen next.
Tom mentioned that the politics that the Fed is having to deal with here, looking ahead to this year and beyond, how are we going to strike a balance here between what the Fed wants to do, what the Fed is doing, what Congress wants the Fed to be doing, and the White House? I mean, it seems like this is going to be a particularly thorny field for all of these participants to have to navigate here.
Yeah.
How difficult is it going to be?
Very difficult, in short. I mean, I wouldn't want to be chairing the Fed right now. You're not going to please all the people all the time. In fact, you're probably likely to upset most of the people most of the time with Fed policy this year. They are going to be at least attempting to hike rates. If they respond to the macro data, they're going to be seen as taking the punch bowl away from the party, etc. These sort of usual cliches. If they don't, they're going to be criticised for being behind the curve. They've been criticised in the past for juicing the stock market, supporting politicians. Does that change under President-elect Trump once he gets inaugurated? Will he like them to juice the stock market? It's a very difficult one. How can you operate in those environments?
Well, that's the unexpected. Yeah. That maybe we'll begin to hear about today at this press conference. When was the last press conference of David Gurrell? Was it
more than 150 days ago?
167, I believe.
Yeah, 167?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, maybe it begins today with this press conference. What's Rob Cornell's unexpected for Janet Yellen and for our economics that underpins all that we do?
Well, her unexpected, I think it's what they deliver in the next couple of months. I don't think anyone's really expecting them to move in March. I'm struggling to think why they wouldn't.
And you mentioned earlier, I believe, on Bloomberg Television, wage growth is just the mystery that's out there.
This is the one that's the dog that's finally barking. We are now beginning to see wages growth picking up and picking up in a reasonable fashion. What happens if the core rate of inflation, we know the headline rate of inflation is going to ping up in the next 2 months and push us right into the mid-twos, into sort of levels where you wouldn't expect to see rates as low as they are. If the wages continue to rise, if we start to see the core rate moving with that, and wages, of course, are a big factor in service sector inflation, that's likely to be pushing up, then it looks as if the Fed's left it too late. And they have to then respond to that with faster responses, more tightening. Their three dots. We're not forecasting that ourselves, but that's not looking totally out of the realms of possibility if these things continue moving in that direction.
Very quickly here, help me with polling. How are you regarding polling now as we look ahead to political risk in Europe going forward? Does it tell you what's going on in France or the Netherlands? Are you going to pay less attention to it in light of what we've seen?
The politics in Europe's really, really interesting right now. You've got an incredibly busy political calendar. The one that everybody's really been focusing on, I think maybe inappropriately, mm-hmm. has been France. I think that's actually much less of an issue than anybody's made out.
Okay, Rob Cornell, thank you so much for
talk to you
ING
soon, I hope,
in our studios here in London. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.
want to bring in Francisco Onzaga. She is a lead economist at the World Bank based here in London. The World Bank out with its latest Global Economic Prospects Report, Outlook for the New Year. Great to have you with us here in London at Bloomberg's European headquarters. And I just want to pick up on a quotation from your boss, from Jim Kim, the president of the World Bank, talking about the momentum we're seeing right now, speaking of the need to increase investments in infrastructure and people. Looking ahead to 2017, what's going to catalyze that and who's going to be doing that, do you think?
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being
the
here.
The slowdown in the emerging markets is a real challenge. Investment growth in emerging markets has dropped from 10% in 2010 to 3.4% in 2015 and probably below based on partial data. And that is something that can undermine long-term growth potential. For example, it is highly correlated with productivity growth. And that undermines the potential of future growth prospects, which in turn is required to lift people out of poverty. What can be done? Any number of policies is available, and it really depends on the countries. Some can implement public investment stimulus, which we estimate does have at least over 2 years and benefits for private investment as well. For example, a 1 percentage point increase in public investment growth might lift private investment by 0.3 percentage points. Others don't have that option because of lack of fiscal space. They might want to reallocate expenditures towards higher yielding investment, or they might want to increase tax bases to raise the revenues. And of course, all of this works most when it's complemented with structural reforms to improve business climates.
We talk an awful lot about the uncertainty that certainly overlaid the U.S. and the United Kingdom. You're focused on emerging markets. Does the same sort of political uncertainty persist there as well? It's a broad brush, I suppose, say emerging markets. But.
Yes, 2 points on this one. Yes, global policy uncertainty is at a record high, and it is driven by all the major, or most of the major economies. Mm-hmm. And it is something that affects investment. We estimate, for example, if you just look back in history, if you take the period 2010 to 12, the euro area crisis, the policy uncertainty in Europe at the time may have reduced investment growth in the ECA region, Eastern Europe, by 0.6 to 1.3 percentage points. That's global uncertainty. Mm. In addition, we document in our report a clear increase in political risk across emerging markets, which further then weighs on investment growth in them.
In Washington, there's that street between the World Bank and the IMF. I saw you once out on that street breaking up a fist fight. And, you know, there's this contention between the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund where you guys don't talk that much about foreign exchange, about the dollar and dynamics. The fact is, you're putting out your wonderful report on something everyone's focusing on, which is a dearth of investment amid the beginning of emerging market foreign exchange adjustment. Foreign exchange weakened. Rates go up, growth goes down. Isn't investment the first order condition affected by that growth coming down?
That's our concern. So we are interested in advanced economies like the U.S. mainly because of their impact on emerging markets. So I think what you're referring to is the potential for dollar appreciation. And it's true that foreign currency borrowing has increased a lot in emerging markets since the crisis. However, the bulk of borrowing by corporates in emerging markets,
right,
more than 80% remains domestic currency and remains
right
by domestic banks. So their main vulnerability is to a rise in global financing condition.
The only reason I'm going to be nice to you is Dr. Kim once gave me a Dartmouth bow tie, so which I still treasure. It was great. But I don't want to get you in trouble with Dr. Kim. You can't mention the dreaded T word, Mr. Trump. I get the idea that
not trade,
the World
Trump
Bank can't talk about him. But come on, it's a Trump reflation. Call it the U.S. reflation in that. How does that impinge on the body of your important report? The answer is it's a huge deal, right?
It's the U.S. is a big part of the global economy, a quarter of global GDP, a tenth of global trade. So what happens in the U.S., of course, does not stay in the U.S. It has global implications. But that said, the newer Trump administration's policies, there has been much discussion about them. We simply do not have enough detail to incorporate them into our forecasts. So when we say that we expect growth in the U.S. to rise from 1.6 to 2.2% in 2017, it is excluding all these policies that are currently being mooted.
Yeah. This is important, David, because within the report, there's more talk about the U.S. than I've ever seen.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about China, and you project a slowdown in growth there. Where will we see growth? Where's the most growth going to come from? Is it in South Asia? in the next year? Where do you see the bright spots in the global economy right now?
Clearly, China is slowing gradually just as expected. We expect 6.5% growth in 2017, 6.3% in 2018 and 19. And the authorities are conducting a careful balancing act between reducing vulnerabilities, financial vulnerabilities, and steering activity with the occasional stimulus. Now, surprisingly, there's actually a whole group of emerging markets that has done fairly well since the crisis, and those are the commodity importers. It's only one third of emerging markets.
Well, Poland,
in developing economies.
I mean, Poland's not an emerging market, I would suggest, but Poland has done really well.
Poland is one, but the others that have perhaps done best are the ones in East Africa, West Africa. It's Ethiopia, it's the Rwandas, and the Senegals. And one of the reasons they've done well is, yes, they've benefited from low oil prices, but also they have implemented a lot of public investment to support growth.
Is the United Kingdom on its way to becoming an emerging market under your definition?
We have revised our forecast downwards for the UK to 1.2% in 2017 in line with the Treasury. But you have to take into account that we published our last forecast long before the Brexit vote.
The phrase new normal is probably overused, but when you look at investment, to circle back to investment, you see where it is now. Is there a risk that we're at a level that we're going to stay at, that we're not going to see as high investment as we've seen?
Those are certainly the expectations, the long-term expectations of the consensus. And that is our concern, that really the investment growth is not going to pick up absent a big policy push. That is a whole package of measures. No single measure there's no silver bullet. No single measure will lift investment growth.
I'm interested just in the particular difficulties of putting together an outlook like this amid so much uncertainty. You write about Europe. Tom asked about Poland. You write about Europe, and there is the sense there that things could change radically depending on what happens in certain elections, what happens with the European Union, whether or not things stay as cohesive as they have. How tricky was it to assemble something like this many hundreds of page long report during this particular climate?
Yeah, we do try to measure risk and uncertainty in a fan chart. So we do estimate that the uncertainty around our baseline forecast has increased since last time we published. But the way we try to get at it is by scenario analysis. For example, we do a scenario. We estimate a scenario of what would happen if the U.S. cut taxes the way it has been proposed.
Mm-hmm. That would be Mr. Trump.
That would be the new administration, yes.
Very good. So you got around that nicely. As the new administration suggests, then what would happen?
So we estimate, and we're using the Fed's own model, so we estimate that that may raise growth in the U.S. to up to 2.5% this year in 2017 and up to 2.9% in 2018. But that's under many assumptions. First, that this is actually implemented. As proposed, both corporate and income tax cuts, and that would be a large revenue loss, a sizable revenue loss. Second, that there are no offsetting other expenditure, for example, expenditure measures. Third, that the U.S. Fed does not behave in any different way as the model projects. For example, it raises interest rates faster than expected. And fourth, it does not take into account possible trade policies. And these trade policies would matter for the way that U.S. growth feeds into global growth.
Within the zeitgeist of the World Bank, very quickly here, is there just an understanding that the age of multilateralism is over? Within the vast bureaucracy of Dr. Kim's World Bank, is it adjusting to a bilateral World Bank?
So we certainly flag the risk of rising protectionism as one of the key risks, the first risk actually we've mentioned, to global growth. But that goes beyond any individual country. If you look at the G20 countries, the number of new trade restrictive measures in 2016 was a record high. And there were, again, yet another year, more trade restrictive measures implemented than liberalizing ones.
That's all the time we have. This has been absolutely fantastic. Francesca Anzergay, thank you so much. She is with the World Bank. David Gurin, Tom Keene in London, worldwide. This is Bloomberg. It is a good day. If any day is a good day to speak to Dennis Gartman, but it's a particularly good day today. Mr. Gartman writes a newsletter. He is one of the brave and foolish who actually put his track record at the back of the newsletter, forcing Gartman to be one of the great pinatas of business news, and undeserved, I might point out, because we are all wrong at numerous and frequent moments. Dennis, let me migrate to the politics first. What would be your first question to Mr. Trump this morning at the press conference?
Why are you so incredibly attuned or in favor of some sort of trade protection if you understand the history of the modern world where tariffs and trade protection always give way to weaker economic environments domestically and politically? Why are you pushing ahead with that? That would be my very first question, Tom.
Do you perceive that there are adults in the room, or at least budding within the administration, that will amend, adjust, adapt the Trumpian message?
No, I'm fearful that there are no adults in the room. I have not seen anybody yet other than the gentlemen who have been professing or promoting even greater trade protection. So I'm afraid that there are no adults in the room, and that is a great fear on my part. Hopefully cooler minds will prevail. Hopefully adults will show up. But right now, I have not seen that, and that is disconcerting to me.
How do you read the tweets about Ford and GM and Boeing and Lockheed? Do you see these as one-offs, as things unto themselves, not representative of some sort of larger industrial policy? What's your read on his targeting of individual companies?
I think it's dangerous. I wish he wouldn't do that. In the first edition of the Gartman letter this year, I put out my surprises for the year, and my one hope surprise was that the president would stop tweeting. For a couple of days, it appeared that he had, but now he seems to be tweeting even more aggressively than he had in the past. I find this dangerous. Making opinion by tweets is something that simply should not be, it shouldn't be done.
That's like you get whipsawed on oil, Dennis. I had to say that. I just had to get that in there. Dennis,
well, at least you haven't said anything about my beloved Wolfpack losing by a mere 50 cents.
Oh, yes, almost 2-1. Almost. On a snowy night at the Dean Dome. Yeah, it was a tough loss for you, Dennis.
We didn't want to go there. Dennis Gartman, seriously, though, this has to do with stability, and there's any ways to go here. But I just put out a chart on Twitter off the Bloomberg Terminal, folks, of Turkish lira. And as Dennis would say, it's an elegant chart. There is a persistency here. Dennis, I am dismayed by people who dismiss this in oddities of Bloomberg chit-chat. They're not. They're really linked in their own unknowable way into all that we do when you see Mexico and Turkey unravel.
Well, I think take a look also at what's happened to Bitcoin in the past week and a half or 2 weeks. I mean, it's astonishing what is taking place in the foreign exchange market. Not enough people pay attention to foreign exchange. Thankfully, this audience does. But when you get to the broad public, they pay very little attention, and they should be paying a great good deal more. What happens in the lira is important. What happens in the Mexican peso is important. What happens in Bitcoin is important. What happens in gold is important, and it's not paid attention to enough.
So what's going through Dennis Gartman's mind as you watch the depreciation of the lira? We had the central bank intervening yesterday trying to do something about it. Doesn't seem like that worked out that well. What are you thinking as you watch this depreciation?
You know, it's not just the central bank there that has failed. Take a look at probably the one central bank that people had a great deal of confidence in, the Swiss National Bank, that has been trying to keep its own currency down and can't do that. Normally, a central bank, if they want to do anything, can always keep their currency lower, and they can't. So what we have learned from this is that central bank powers are being diminished in the modern world. I think that's the lesson to be taken away from here.
You know, we were talking to Bill Dunkelberg yesterday about his NFIB Small Business Optimism Report, which is something that the president-elect clearly took an interest in. He tweeted it out three times yesterday, flagging this as a good sign for the economy. What's your read of that data that we got from the NFIB yesterday? Is the message from that simply the economy is doing pretty well here, don't screw it up?
I think what it tells us is in the flyover states, things are doing actually quite a good deal better. The deplorables, as Mrs. Clinton would have called us, seem to be doing okay. There was a great deal of enthusiasm that has been engendered by the arrival or the soon-to-be arrival of the Trump administration, and I think that the coasts have not understood what has really taken place. I thought that was a very important bit of economic data that came out yesterday, showing the NFIB number up as dramatically as it was. That was a very impressive rise in that index, and I think it shows that animal spirits, according to Mr. Keynes, are in fact rising out there.
I know he wants to talk about red wheat as well. Well, he was calling that out yesterday.
We'll do that
in the next segment. Before we get there, you brought up Bitcoin, and I know that you haven't been a big enthusiast for Bitcoin. What's it going to take for you to to get more interested in cyber currencies, or do you think this is really a flash in the pan, albeit a years long flash in the pan?
At 66 years old, I think I'm a bit too old to understand what Bitcoin really is, and I simply won't I won't be able to put that a great good deal of trust in it, especially with the volatility mm-hmm. that has been incumbent in that one currency. It's astonishing. You cannot move a currency 20% in a week and expect to see that become a usable instrument for the purchase of goods and services.
Is it a currency, Dennis Gartman?
Well, they call it that. What is the terminology?
A
cryptocurrency.
I'll give you crypto.
It's a thing. It's something to be traded right now, and that's about all it is.
Thank you. We'll do trading theory and red wheat here with Dennis Gartman in the next section. But I want to stay on theme
now,
Dennis. Dennis, there's everyone agrees, massive and original uncertainty here. You just happened to mention your age.
Yeah.
I put out a photo of my favorite photo of the president, which is him sitting on the Rosa Parks bus, of the history of this president and all that he stands for. I want you to speak to our listeners who are overwhelmed by the uncertainty of the times. How do you stay invested? How do you have confidence in your little pot of money, given the uncertainty that we face?
We always have faced uncertainty. We're going to face uncertainty tomorrow. We will face uncertainty next month. We'll face uncertainty next year. We've always faced it. We've always done better. That's just been the trend. There were some of my friends who were Clinton supporters were obviously greatly dismayed. The country will be fine. No matter who had become the president, the country will be fine. My wife was very despondent, thinking that Mrs. Clinton was going to win, and I had to tell her, sweetheart, Margaret, it's going to be okay. Have a drink. You'll be fine.
You okay over there, girl?
I'm taking the marital advice here from Dennis Gartman.
Got a book coming up. Have a drink. You'll be fine. There's a title. With that, Dennis, let's switch to your trading. We'll do this in our next section.
Good,
but to go out here, Dennis, give me the why of the look back of 2016. Why was it so hard to take a prudent trading stance, whether it was a 3-month trade or a 9-month trade? Why was it so darn hard?
Yeah, I wish I could understand that. I got stopped out of good trades so many times last year. It was terribly disconcerting to get the major trend right and to be taken out on small interim corrections is the most debilitating, disturbing, soul-destroying circumstance that one can go through. I wish I had the answer. If I did, I wouldn't be talking to you today. I'd be out in Monaco, or I'd be down in Bali enjoying myself. That is the great uncertainty that investors and traders have to deal with.
To our audience south of your Virginia, I know Clemson's going to Disneyland. Wasn't that a good thing to see? I mean, just for the sport. Was that a good thing to see Alabama defeated?
Oh, absolutely. It was wonderful. As an Atlantic Coast Conference devotee, to see Clemson, a land-grant university, I might
say.
There
we go.
We can agree. We can agree on that.
Do you know that Gartman last year made so much money in his speaking fees, he bought a 48-foot Grand Banks, and he called the puppy Landgraf, just to get people going. Dennis Gartman with us. David, why don't you jump in here with Dennis?
I know you want to get into commodities. Let me stick with currencies for 1 minute more. Yeah. We're here in London. We're wrapped with attention watching the Prime Minister Theresa May speaking to Sky News this weekend, writing for The Telegraph about the Brexit process. What have you learned, Dennis Gartman, about where this is headed? What have you learned about the contours of a UK-EU trade policy and what that means for sterling?
I think when all of this has run its course, England will, in fact, the UK will, in fact, leave. There will be a British removal from the continent, from the political circumstance. That's going to happen. The voters have made it clear. They will accommodate or will be accommodated by Germany and France. There will be some reconciliation. Cooler heads, adult minds will prevail. And this will all resolve itself. Will the pound sterling be under pressure until that resolution comes to effect later sometime this year? Yes, probably sterling shall be. But in the end, as almost all of these events avail themselves, there will be decency and good nature that will finally come to the surface. That's the way it always is resolved.
The way it always is, Dennis, in commodities, is there's just a presumed chronic deflation or disinflation of price.
Yeah.
I don't know much about red wheat. It's a reddish grain. a major classification of the United States.
Hard red winter wheat as opposed to soft red winter wheat.
And I have no idea if I can tell that in my gluten-free bread here in London.
Definitely not.
Yes, folks, I did eat gluten-free bread last night. Dennis, help me here with the price erosion in the softs and particularly in wheat. Is it back to the pre-China disinflation for commodities?
I think it's simply the fact that we are so good at producing crops around the world, whether it's wheat, whether it's soybeans, whether it's corn, whether it's cotton. If you take a look at the history of the last 40 years, every time you look at how much production per acre of any of the major grains or any of the major commodities has been, it's always been higher, drought in, flood out. Yes, you have problems that can occur because of weather, but on balance, we're just simply better at producing amounts of commodities on the same amount of acreage than we were 40 years ago. In fact, in the case of corn, we're probably tripled what we can do, what a good farmer 50 years ago would grow. We're probably producing triple that now, and that's not going to stop anytime soon, thanks to the Penn States, the Ohio States.
The land grant schools. Texas A&M.
Texas A&M.
Dennis,
Cal Davis.
Let me get back on script here, Dennis. Help me. The China commodity boom, then, do you perceive that globally and domestically as a one-off?
No. I think that the Chinese circumstance of the last 10 years, 15 years, as China has leaped from the 14th century into the 22nd century, and they're not going to go back, Chinese consumers are going to be demanding carpets and rugs and brass plumbing fixtures and wooden furniture and better housing. There are still 800 million people in the western provinces that have to move to the eastern provinces and shell, and that will have to be accommodated as the world gets wealthier and the world is getting wealthier. That's going to continue. But what I think shall end up happening is that as demand continues to grow, the ability to produce more will keep track with it. And in fact, if anything, will outpace it. That's been the history of the last 100 years, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Dennis, in the limited time we have left here, let me ask you about oil. I know you've been looking at the correlation between WTI and Brent. At this point, what does that tell you? What does that correlation tell you about the energy market?
Well, I think what's most important is the relationship between front month to back month WTI and front month to back month Brent. We're continuing to watch the contango, the carrying charge, widen. Even as prices have risen, the contango has widened, which tells you that crude, as I like to say, is bidding for storage. Crude is forcing itself, or the abundance of crude, and there is an abundance of crude, is forcing back months to be stronger than front months. It's telling you that there's an oversupply. And when in a contangoed market, it's very difficult to be bullish of crude oil under any circumstance. There's just simply more of it. We find more of it. We're better at producing it. We're better at finding it. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to end anytime soon either.
Quickly, Dennis, have you amended your gold stance given the Trump reflation?
Actually, if anything, I have become more amenable to owning gold, not in dollar terms, because I'm really quite bullish of the U.S. dollar, and long gold in dollar terms is an implied bet against the dollar, and I'm not willing to make that. However, if you take a look at what gold did last year in terms of the euro, and I think this is an important statistic, the stock market, the S&P, was up, 9% last year, but gold in euro terms was up much more than that. People don't understand that fact. I want to be bullish of gold, but only in terms of currencies that I think will continue to diminish in value. And I think that's primarily the euro first and the yen second.
Dennis Gartman, thank you so much. The Gartman letter, always interesting. I just put out on Twitter the Wikipedia and land-grant schools.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in a house of land-grant excellence, as Mr. Gartman.
Upstate New York has a good one.
Cornell, they have like a split school. You've got two schools.
Almost. Ag school, you've got the architecture school, engineering school.
Yeah.
Plenty, so.
Each of them with their own character. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member, SIPC.